who's one of our most vibrant and consistently interesting of contemporary novelists, I think. She's written at the last count, I think, 12 novels, yes, beginning with Pause Between Acts, which was published in 1988, and which won the, I never know how to pronounce it, John Winnie, first novel prize, anyway,
pass.
And culminating in the most recent, from which she's going to be reading today, Yesterday's Houses. Now, I have been a fervent Cheek fan for many years, but ever since I first came across Pause Between Acts, and Mavis has, you know, a huge and devoted following, and her novels sell in enviable and enormous numbers. But one thing I've noticed is that her readers tend to regard her as their own private discovery. And when I've discovered, or you know, friends have discovered, often by accident, that a friend is also a Mavis Cheek fan, I feel slightly miffed, because I regard her as my writer, you know, and you know, we're quite a sort of exclusive and yet absolutely enormous club for Mavis Cheek readers. And I think this has to do with the special kind of relationship, the particular kind of ironic intimacy which her novels establish with the reader. For me, the particular pleasure of reading a Mavis Cheek novel is akin to that of spending the evening with a cherished friend who you don't see very often. You know, the sort of evening, sort of rich and funny evening in which ideas fizzle and both of you are kind of breathtakingly witty and heartbreakingly wise, and you exchange stories and gossip which range from high drama to farce, from books to life, from the poignant to the caustic to the self-mocking. I was interested that in the sex life of my aunt, an interview, a wonderful title, isn't it, for a novel, you said that the last part of the novel is a conversation which you couldn't then have with your sister, and maybe one thing we might come back to later is this question of whether you do actually conceive your novels as, at some level, a kind of conversation or a dialogue. I'd be interested to hear later about that. Anyway, Mavis Cheek's novels are most often, I suppose, classified as comedies of manners, which places them, you know, quite clearly in the Jane Austen tradition, which I think is right if we think of Jane Austen's novels as coming at the end of the 18th century rather than at the beginning of the 19th century. In other words, Jane Austen as Regency writer rather than as kind of proto-Victorian writer. And what I think, I mean, I just want to suggest some of the things that I think Mavis Cheek shares with Jane Austen is a kind of Georgian elegance of style and plot, an impeccable comic timing, an erudition lightly worn, and a capacity, I think, to move almost imperceptibly between many different shades of comedy, from what we call blunt humour to subtle innuendo, from fierce satire to playful whimsy. And what I think is one of the most difficult things to pull off, the capacity to retain simultaneously ironic distance and immediacy. As Maureen Freely said in a review of one of Mavis's earlier novels, she does not enter her characters' heads so much as mimic their thoughts, which of course is true of Jane Austen as well. Now, Austen never gave up on romance in her novels, but equally, she never lost sight of the meaning and importance of material things. And I think she would have appreciated the central thread in Mavis's most recent novel, Yesterday's Houses, which hinges on a woman's search for the perfect bathroom, and from which you will now read Mavis Cheek.
Right, thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful distillation of my writing. I hope this will live up to it for you all. This is where I start dropping things. I'm the most elegant of people. But I have to tell you that before I read anything, I did want to say, did anybody get The Guardian today? Shocking. Shock to the core. Well, you missed a treat, girls. I've gotten my spectacles, you see. You missed a treat. Because there's a little piece at the bottom of page 5 or something, which shows us that the third world has surpassed us. I've just done a review of Jane Jusker's book, second book. Do you remember Jane Jusker? She did a book called Round-Heeled Woman, which was a 64-year-old woman advertising for sex in the New York Review of Books. Do you remember that? Wonderful idea. Wish I'd got there first. Haven't got to 64 yet, though. But I've just reviewed that, and, you know, it's now about her when she was sort of 71 and what happened. And I've reviewed it very very thoroughly and very enthusiastically. But this takes the biscuit. This is where the third world, so-called, you know, leaps ahead of us in leaps and bounds. Here we go. This is Malaysia, girls. Sorry, chaps. 33-year-old man in northern Malaysia has married a 104-year-old woman, saying mutual respect and friendship had turned to love. I don't know why you're giggling over this. It's wonderful. The Star newspaper said yesterday it was Muhammad Noor Che Musa's first marriage and his wife's 21st, said the Star, which cited a report in the Malay language tabloid. The ex-serviceman said he found a sense of belonging after meeting Wook Kondor, adding that he had initially sympathised with her because she was old and alone. I'm not after her money, as she is poor, he said. Before meeting Wook, I never stayed in one place for long. Well, I don't know what that does for you, but it gives me tremendous hope. Tremendous hope. You see, you put that in a book. I have to tell you, you put that in a book and no one would let you. Your editor would go puce. I want to share another little thing that arrived just as I was leaving the house. This is amused. I love getting fan mail. I get quite a lot of fan mail, I have to say. Sacks and sacks of it. But this is from someone called Belinda Bruce Gardner, so she's obviously well-educated and knows a thing or two. She's a great fan of mine, which is lovely. And she says, you probably will not believe this. And I don't. But I was at a friend's father's funeral 2 weeks ago, and the priest made no less than 4 references to your book, which he'd just finished reading as well. He said he felt obliged to read it in order to keep up with the social mores of today, but I think he was just another fan of your work. So obviously I'm going to write back to Belinda Bruce Gardner and ask what the priest said. What were the bits of my book that he quoted on? Now, a little bit about me. I'm even more excited by what was said about my work just now by my lovely colleague here, because some of you will know this and some of you won't, but I failed my 11 plus twice. It's not something that I say very often out loud, but I did. And I was put into a secondary modern school, which they don't have anymore. Well, I think they do, but I don't think they're called secondary moderns. I think they're called ordinary education now. And I was put into a B stream there, which was where the real sort of... Not a C stream. There was a C stream for the real thickos who had strangely cut hair and looked odd, you know. But we were in the B stream, where we were not allowed to do what were called GCEs then. We weren't really allowed to learn to be a full-blown secretary because they had to be bright. But we were allowed to learn to be clerk typists. And that's what I trained. I went to school at my secondary modern from the age of 11. And then I was forced to stay on for another year. I could have left at 15, but then they changed it, so I had to stay on until I was 16. And all that time, what they were doing was teaching me clerk typing. With a little bit of shorthand thrown in. Well, I refused to learn shorthand on the grounds that it was symbols and I liked words. typing I was very ham-fisted at. And we used to have the occasional lessons in with the secretaries, which was all about how to look after your man, your boss, the boss, much of which seemed to centre on keeping your skirts long, washing under your armpits, and keeping your fingernails short. And I used to sit there puzzling how this was going to work with this wonderful boss that I was going to have, and you know what particular aspects of that he was going to like. I think I know now. So that's what I was doing for my educational life. I think it's been recorded somewhere, but I'll say it again. I was the sort of archetypal dolly bird in the 60s. You know, it was. I had hair like a pair of curtains. I had these enormous vacant blue eyes, and in those days we used to paint eyelashes on as well, sometimes freckles. So I must have looked wonderfully vacant and probably rather pretty, and I wore very short skirts. And it was also that the 60s were, for women of course, but for everyone, but for women particularly, a sort of real democratic blip. Suddenly everything was, all hell was breaking loose for us. And questions of social class, for example, were being thrown out. And I came from a very working class background, a very poor background. My mother was a single parent working in a factory, you know, making filing systems, and that's what she did. And we were extremely poor. Her background was East End, with, you know, her mother having had 10 kids and being a cleaner. So it was, you know, right on. And then came the 60s, and suddenly some places like the art world, which had been run very much by Debs and Ons and things, suddenly thought they'd get a little bit of this democratic blip that was going on. And in the case of an art gallery called Editions Electo, which published wonderful contemporary work, first publishers of David Hockney, Patrick Caulfield, Bridget Riley, you know, you name it, that's what they were doing, which was run by Nobs and Ons, they thought they'd get a little bit of this democratic blip in me. And I was employed as their receptionist. This dolly bird with her vacant blue eyes and her very short skirts. And that's what I did for the first year of my life when I left school at 16. You can't imagine what it was like for me suddenly listening to the likes of someone, Zandra Carnegie, from the great Carnegie family, who worked. We used to go up to Barker's and get our hard-boiled egg sandwiches together. But she would, sometimes there would be a phone call. I remember it the first time it happened, I thought it was a laugh. There was a phone call from, Countess Carnegie's butler ringing for Zandra, and I actually remember saying, oh yeah, you know, pull the other one, mate. So it was an astoundingly different world for me. But those 60s were fantastic for women. I mean, we really did think that we could change the world. I do remember thinking that there was nothing that wasn't open to me if I really wanted it. In fact, I almost didn't think it. It was just sort of there and a great glowing thing going on. And you could cut the mustard with any sort of person in any sort of situation. I used to go to the most fabulous art parties where Princess Margaret would turn up in a tiara and jeans and stuff like that. It's crazy stuff. And then I learned the art. I learned all about contemporary art, and I ended up actually running a gallery in London's West End when I was 19, which seems amazing now, but so I was. And at that point, and I'm going to refer you now to Sex Life of My Aunt, which is the book that I wrote two books ago. There's Patrick Parker before it, but then Sex Life of My Aunt. And that book, I suddenly decided that I was going to write. It was the millennium, and a lot of us writers had a strange feeling that we wanted to write our memoirs, our autobiographies, you know, particularly Hilary Mantel. And I remember talking to Beryl Bainbridge and her, and she saying, about myself now. And I decided that I was going to write my autobiography. And I remember going out to lunch with my publisher and my agent and then saying, what about the new book then? Davis? And I said, yes, it's going to be my autobiography. And I, the smile on their faces was like this. Lovely. Because what they wanted was another novel. Anyway, I tried writing the first bit of this autobiography in Sex Life of My Aunt and failed miserably because it was very sort of mordant. Oh, so sad. Very, very, as I would say, very early drabble. And so I abandoned that and I thought, well, what is it I do best? And I thought, well, what I do best is write fiction. So what I decided with that book, Sex Life of My Aunt, was to write the truth of my life story, but not too heavily, up until the age of 19. And then what happened to me in truth, in reality, in my own life at the age of 19 was that there I was in this fab art gallery in the West End with this wonderful art, having a lovely life. And there was an extremely lovely, wealthy, older than me lawyer who fell deeply and wonderfully in love with me and asked me to marry him. And I, as so many of us women and young women in those days, just thought, there's another bus coming along, I'm not going to stop my life. But, you know, no. Well, of course, there wasn't another bus coming along, and, you know, that was only retrospectively what I realised. But I turned him down. And then I went through my own machinations of life and ended up where I am now. But what I did with Sex Life of My Aunt was I took the heroine in truth myself to the age of 19, but instead of her turning him down, I had the heroine say yes to that marriage. In a way, knowing that she was not, as I did, I mean, I turned him down because I did not love him in that passionate way. That exciting, burning way that I felt you needed to if you were going to marry someone. Learn me lesson now, of course. But I had it so that she said yes, understanding those things that she was giving up, but those things that she was gaining. You know, in a rather silly way, you could say white goods. So that was that book. That was Sex Life of My Aunt. Then there was a break where I wrote Patrick Parker's Progress, which is very much done in the same vein as this idea about women and where they were then in the world, where they are now. I'm very conscious of the fact that, and we might come back to this when we do questions and answers, that I think women have lost out a great deal from where we were in the 60s and early 70s, but we can come back to that. But so I wrote Patrick Parker's Progress to go slightly further back in time, back to the 50s, really, to look at the heroine there and how she was. And then Niggle, 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 Didn't Leave Me Alone, Haven't Finished Your Own Life, Come On, Cheek, get cracking with it. So I thought with this book, which was Yesterday's Houses, I would complete the story, really. So leaving my heroine at 19 in Sex Life of My Aunt and then taking a fictitious leap, I went back to approximately that age. I think Marianne Flowers in the opening of this is 17. And wrote what is really autobiographical about me. But it's what I think Muriel Spark called an imaginary extension of the truth. So I haven't hung around thinking I've got to stick to the truth here. You know, I've invented an awful lot, and what I'm astonished by as I wrote it was how much I did remember. So that basically is what Yesterday's Houses is. The structure bothered me because I really didn't want to do this sort of and then I, and then I, and then I. So I took every single house I've ever lived in. Each chapter is set in one of the houses or flats that I lived in the course of my life to ending up being here. And that was a lovely structure because it meant that I didn't have to do all that fitting in. I could have each house and take an incident from each house that happened to the heroine, me, and then move on to the next house. And it was a wonderfully liberating experience, and I hope for the reader it's a sort of liberating experience for the reader. Now, one of the things that worried me about this book tremendously was that it is a heroine's quest for a wonderful bathroom. Does she get it? Yes, she does. Did all the bathrooms that I have described in here that our heroine suffers exist? Yes, they did. All of those are absolutely accurate. I lived through all those bathrooms. Those bathrooms. Bovary might be him, but those bathrooms, c'est moi. And I got rather worried that when the book came out, this would be taken as flippancy. So I armed myself. It was quite interesting. I armed myself with a couple of things in case it was going to be taken as flippancy. One of which was that Virginia Woolf, when she made her enormous amount of money from Mrs. Dalloway, huge royalties, I mean, runaway stuff, the very first thing she did was put a bathroom and a separate lavatory into Monkshood, their house. That was the very first thing she did. And lest, you know, sometimes the chaps like to say, well, that's a ditzy old writer. Marie Curie, when she won the Nobel Prize, the very first thing she did was use the money to put a bathroom in to their house. So I felt I was in very good ground. So, but also, what happened was it never happened. Nobody ever said, oh, how silly it is, pursuing a bathroom, blah, blah, don't understand it. Everybody got it. I mean, I won't tell you that the, you know, fiction editors who came up to me at parties and said, I really, really relate to that, but so they did. So that was a comfort. And we'll do some questions and answers later about anything else that you want to talk about. But basically, I hope this book is a celebration, really, of what I lived through and what women have lived through and what men have lived through as well in terms of changing and growth. And I just feel that we should watch it now. I'm slightly worried that we're ceding too much. You know, I do think, for example, there's a wonderful discussion, I haven't got time to go into it here, this morning on the radio, about transvestites and transsexuals and mothers talking about how they suddenly realised their children were transsexual, transvestites by changes in behaviour. So I do think that women have certain qualities that at their peril do they cede, particularly at their peril do they cede, unless they get something back. Because when I researched Mrs. Fitton's Country Life, which is another of my books, I was astonished to learn about how much women had, what powers women had had in the past. And I don't just mean, you know, growing crystals and the witch and all that stuff. You know, I mean actual power, you know, like, you know, money-making power, like being alewives and being the people who, you know, basically ran the health service. And all those things are gradually taken away, so, you know, that's a little worry I have, that we shouldn't cede our roles in life, not unless we get a big fat check for it. Okay. So, see how we go. I've talked far too long, and I always do. This is the very beginning. Marianne Flowers is my heroine, and this is the opening bit for you. Marianne Flowers went to a party when she was 17. It was held in a very big house in a quiet suburb of London, a house with a long front path and a big bay window and double front doors with a stained glass window panel at each side. The front garden was big and overgrown, but oddly to Marianne, it did not look unpleasantly neglected. It looked interesting and slightly mysterious. Where she lived, if a garden was neglected, it meant it looked shabby and mucky and shameful. This garden must belong to what her mother would call a better class of person. It was early in the year. She rang the doorbell, which was loud and long and made her jump. A bold sound, an announcement that could not be ignored. Marianne shrank into herself a little. It did not do, so she'd been brought up to think, to draw attention to yourself. She hunched in the doorway and waited. The house, like the garden, had a run-down, dingy look about it, which was intriguing, but also a little unnerving. If Marianne were an educated girl, or had read Northanger Abbey and Jane Eyre, she would know that the house had a Gothic air about it. But she was not yet educated, and all she could think was, ooh, spooky, and ooh, spiders. Marianne had never been in a house like this for any social reason, though her doctor and dentist had their surgeries in such places when she was growing up, and she was quite in awe of it. Quite tickled to be there as a guest instead of as a patient. These were the kind of houses Marianne walked past and wondered about, and which often had interesting people with lots to say for themselves going in and out of their solid front doors. These were the people who did not look respectable, as her mother might say, people who did not hang net curtains. As she waited for the door to be opened, she felt a flutter of excitement. Marianne's life had been quite dull, quite mundane, a word she'd just learned and liked until now, ordinary. What she would one day come to hear called respectable working class and suburban. Entering this new world of what she would also come to hear called the intellectual and bohemian was exciting, different. The porch in which she stood and waited, for example, was nearly as big as her back bedroom at home. She could judge the desirability of this new world only by such things. Yes, you could definitely get a single bed in the porch. The reason Marianne was at the house was because someone she'd met at a bus stop in Kingston-upon-Thames had kissed her hand and said that there was to be a party at number 3 Laburnum Grove and he would meet her there. He was small and blonde with a pair of mustard yellow stacked boots and a lilac floral shirt, and he, like the flowers, was exotic looking. She forgot to ask his name, so that when the door to the house was opened and she was asked whom she was with, she could only shake her head. But then the girl with the long dark hair and bare feet who had opened the door seemed to lose interest and drift away. So in Marianne went. Even she knew enough to compare what she felt with Alice's experience of Wonderland, and if she'd read through the looking glass, she would have felt it was like that, too. She marvelled at the hallway and the long flight of stairs. She marvelled at an old mirror which reflected her as a girl with a flower in her hair, flowers at her neck, and several alarming black spots all over her face. In years to come, she would learn that mirrors were silvered, that old mirrors lost some of their silvering, and that caused the reflected one to look spotty. But for now, she put her hand to her face in wonder, but found that when she moved her reflection, the spot stayed in the same place. This was a big relief, as Marianne was worried that she might have contracted something on the bus coming over. The party noise came from the room immediately to her left, into and out of which people drifted with glasses of wine, red mostly, very sophisticated, or cigarettes, talking and laughing and holding each other, quite wonderfully careless of what anyone thought. One man in particular had his hand down the front of the dress of the girl he was with, and the strange thing was, she did not seem to notice. How very cool that looked. Marianne made a brief note to stop herself all that silly stuff about removing wandering hands in future. It was tiresome anyway, and they always crept back. She did not quite have the courage to go into the party room immediately. Instead, she went up the stairs, passing one or two smudgy-eyed girls and shaggy-haired boys with silk scarves knotted round their throats. Someone remarked on her dress they liked it, and Marianne smiled at the girl who'd spoken, but the girl had already looked away. That, too, seemed the ultimate in cool, to be so detached from everything. Marianne would come to learn this trick, that it did not do in the blossoming age of existentialism to be like a floppy puppy and rush up to people and bloody well be nice and expect a pat for it. But for now she was finding the whole thing something of a dream, and she felt honoured to be there. Nevertheless, a welcome note of physical practicality struck, because Marianne needed the bathroom, what she referred to in those days as the lavvy or the lav, but which she would one day come to learn was called the lavatory or the loo, and never, ever the toilet, unless you were being ironic. She tried a number of doors on the pale yellow landing, causing some rufflings as she disturbed the various bedroom activities, but eventually she found the right room and in she went. How it took her breath away, this bathroom and lavvy combined. Now, this really was bigger than her bedroom at home. It was tiled in white and black, and it had walls of a strange pale greenish colour that ought to have been vomit-worthy, but which looked just right. Later, she would learn this was called Odenille and was one of the great Art Deco colours. She sat on the high square lavatory with its wooden seat, not plastic then, and felt the warmth from the enormous chunky radiator creep all around her. There was something so indulgent about having heating in the bathroom, instead of gritting your teeth at the removal of each garment as the air stabbed at you with its icy little pickaxes. How she longed to get into that huge white bath and see how it felt. How magnificent it looked, balanced there, in the centre of the room on its grand clawed feet, like a supine lion offering its body to be entered. It was luxurious by any stretch, thought Marianne. And when she pulled the lavvy's chain and the water cascaded perfectly, unlike the one at home, which needed a knack, she did dare to climb into the white belly of the sleeping creature. And it was comfortable and big and generous, and for a moment or two she pretended that she owned such a wonderful bath, and she lay there staring up at the ceiling mouldings, slightly grubby but pretty fruit and flowers, and thought how desirable this room was compared to the cramped, cold, lino-covered bathroom at home, with its teensy frosted glass window and its pink candlewick toilet seat cover and matching, drip mat. This was the kind of bathroom she would love to have. It was the first time she had ever understood that a room could be more than its function, that a room could be a kind and thoughtful and comfortable friend. She lay there and she dreamed. Someone rattled the door handle and her heart nearly exploded with guilt as she hopped out of the bath, smoothed down her dress, touched the flowers in her hair and at her neck and opened the door, blushing at the uncool idea of being caught lying fully clothed in a stranger's bath. It was a tall, thin boy about her own age, leaning against the wall as if he might fall down, and wearing a pink shirt with huge flowing sleeves. He had a Zapata moustache and black curly hair in what her mother called a mop. He was absolutely gorgeous, and a very odd colour in his complexion, something like putty. She put on her snootiest air and walked past him. "About bloody time," he said, and as he pushed himself upright he winked at her with one rather bloodshot eye and tickled one of her cheeks. "Sweet little thing," he said, "cool as you like," but as the door closed behind her she heard him throwing up. She never forgot that bathroom. It was not the bathroom she would choose to reproduce, but the feeling of it. Warm, clean, kind, caring, indulgent. A place where everything worked and where it was nice to spend time. Somewhere for thoughts and dreams and the passing of hours. A haven. Now we might just have a quick... That was her husband, if you haven't guessed it. She would one day marry the man with the Zapata moustache. I think what we might do is just a little bit of this bit about their getting married. They were the first couple out of all their friends to get married, and the only couple, it transpired over the years, to stick to their principled guns and not get married in church. No sumptuous white dress and little bouquet of roses for Marianne, no buttonholes for the family, no pretending you wanted God's blessing or that you had any truck with honouring and obeying anyone. In an ideal world, you lived together and had nothing to do with such bourgeois stupidities. So said Charles, And so said Marianne, if a little wistfully. This marriage was not being made for romance. This marriage was being made for very practical tax reasons. One rose above romance. Charles was very firm on the bourgeois concept of marriage, outmoded institution that it was. He embraced the unconventional. One lived in sin. Only now that they needed to get their foot on the housing market and save hard, marriage was preferable. You could get a mortgage with a marriage. Banks were kind to you with a marriage, and the Inland Revenue positively rained indulgences upon you if you tied the legal knot. On being told all these things, Marianne could see the sense of it. In the hour or so before they were to be wed, Marianne was so nervous that she was practically queuing with herself to pee. Not her usual way. She usually held on to it for as long as possible when she was in the flat, because the alternative, like the bathroom, was so unpleasant. In her dreams, a bathroom held both a bath and a lavatory, but not here. Here, the lavatory was in the oubliette beneath the street at the front of the flat. Successive tenants had attempted to hold back the wetness of the walls with various do-it-yourself solutions. A single bulb revealed tar-backed paper, waterproof coatings, sealants of every variety, none of which worked. Using the lavatory in this place, like taking a bath, was never a pleasure. And as there was no wash basin in either place, the shaving of chins and washing of armpits in the morning rush took place at the kitchen sink. How the serving incumbents of bygone days would have recoiled to see such brutalized activities in their domestic domain. All in all, the basement in Dragon Street was a filthy hole, but yes, definitely cheap, and that counted for everything. Saving, saving, saving was the watchword. We might end it there and do some questions and answers. Is that okay? Thank you.
Well, I'm going to claim greedily the chair's privilege of asking the first question, and then I'm going to throw things over to the floor. And I wanted to ask you, really, I suppose it's a question about how writers, you know, kind of take the materials of their life and then transform them, because when I'm talking to my students, we start talking about autobiographical writing, and I'm constantly saying to them, yes, it may be autobiographical, but it could have been done differently. It didn't have to be done that way, so to speak. And look, when I was Googling Mavis Cheek today, and I'm finding out, I mean, the material of your life is so rich, really. And I mean, if you look at the sort of the details of your childhood, you know,
it's unusual, yes.
But I mean, you could have done a Catherine Cook sonnet.
Oh, good. Yes.
And then, you know, the move to Hillcroft, and
yes,
you know, and sort of,
yes,
then, you know, we could have done Educating Rita, and then there's the whole different story of the 60s and the art world. I mean, there are lots of potential kinds of ways in which you could have used those stories. And yet, I mean, looking at, I mean, it seemed to me that even from Pause Between Acts, you kind of found your voice, that this sort of delicate tension between
the authorial voice.
Yeah,
yes.
And I just wondered whether there was, you know, whether there was, it was a struggle to find that, or whether you just woke up one day and sort of felt comfortable with, you know.
No, not at all. I struggled very hard against it, because my very first novel that I wrote, I'm happy to say, never got published, but it was there was a point in my life. I went to Hillcroft College for mature women at the age of 28, which is a wonderful revelation to me, where I found the other half of my brain. Having been told I couldn't have children, and I was rather devastated by not having children. And after I finished at Hillcroft, I was about to go on and do an MA, and I was throwing up in the mornings. Anyway, I was pregnant, you know. I think I know what caused it now. So at that point, I thought, what can I do to be at home with this lovely baby and, you know, this sweetie baby? I'll be a writer. I mean, it was just part of that old 60s thing where you did think, you know, you had a kind of idea, you could probably do anything if you turned your mind to it. So I thought, I'll be a writer. That is exactly how it happened. And I then went weekly to a writer's group in Richmond, which we can talk about or not. But I conceived eventually the idea of this novel that I was going to write. And at that point in my head, I didn't say it, but in my head, there was James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, and M. Cheek, basically. And we were going to push out the bounds of 20th century literature together. Well, they'd done theirs, and this was mine. And this was written in a very rather pompous, po-faced way. I won't dwell on it. The hero was a businessman who was actually a poet, but couldn't, you know, be a poet and maintain his lifestyle, as it were. There's some irony there. And he conceives a grand passion for a much younger woman who is probably me. And I do remember thinking, he's got to be really old. How old can I make him when he can conceivably still be? I have to make him 60. 60 was as old as I could ever imagine a man could possibly be and still have a, you know, any sort of libido at all. That will tell you the state it was. But what I did with that was that every time a little bubble of humour or irony came up, I put the lid on it. And an agent who eventually took me on, the lovely Imogen Parker, said, you know, I've read this book and, you know, why do you do that? You know, why don't you write a novel like you speak, which is, you're very funny. And I remember saying to her, well, you know, comedy isn't art. Good Lord. And so I quelled my own authorial voice. And when I wrote Pause Between Acts, which came directly out of an experience I had, I have a great way with men in my life. Although I was at that time the mother of a baby and, you know, really very happily with the baby's father, I conceived a grand passion for Ian McKellen. One of those things you do, and then you wonder why you did it, but I did it. And I used to go to every play he was in at least twice. I used to come back on the tube from the National Theatre, you know, these sort of days of glory. And I remember that some friends of ours who were giving a party, I remember that Philip had directed Ian McKellen for telly in Shakespearean cycle of plays, The Kings. So I went up to him at the party and I said, Philip, you know Ian McKellen, don't you? And you must introduce me to him. And at this point he said, well, I'd love to, darling, but you know he's gay. Well, of course I didn't. Not a clue. And I remember going, sitting on a sofa in the corner of their room with an orange juice, thinking, my life is over. My life has just collapsed around my ears. Anyway, Pause Between Acts came out of that experience, the idea of it. And it was in Pause Between Acts I really got my authorial voice, because the next day I do remember laughing at myself and thinking how silly I was, feeling rather tender, but, you know, also how silly I'd been. And then writing that book, which I still think is probably one of my funniest, actually, because I wrote it thinking it'll never get published. And I remember actually, and I was writing it in between, you know, Bella was very small, my daughter. So, you know, they'd be up and then it'd be nap time. She'd suddenly go to sleep and I'd run upstairs and throw her into the cot, run back downstairs. And I know, no, that's not true. Put her gently in the cot, run back downstairs, get in front of the typewriter. It was all written on a manual typewriter. And, you know, for as long as it took, and the baby would sleep for an hour, and then I'd rush back upstairs and get her up. Then she'd sleep in the afternoon. So I learned to be very disciplined. I also learned to have a ball with it. And I once fell off my typing chair with laughter when I was writing that book. And I remember thinking, you cannot keep that bit in. And I thought, oh, yes, I can. So that was the way I discovered it. I had to go through that terrible thing of being very pompous first.
Now, I know what Mavis really enjoys is engaging with the audience. So now is your opportunity. Questions or comments?
Oh, I stunned you all with my terrific intellect about bathrooms. Somebody, tell me, what about bathrooms? Do any of you just only like a shower, or do you all have a special moment when you want a bath? You're not going to tell about your...
There's a question up. Is it?
Yeah. Oh! You can buy plastic covers. You can. On the internet, you can get a plastic cover for a book. horrible thing. I spent so many years with really horrible things. But also, the other thing about a bathroom is that, especially when you've had children, there comes a point in your life as a mum when it's the one place, if you're lucky, you can get into for 10 minutes and be alone. And actually be alone naked, and warm. And you've gone, you know, I remember thinking it was like going back to the womb, even in these crappy baths that I had. For just that short time, I was myself. And then they come, when they're old enough, they come knocking on the door and follow you up there. There is a time in your life when there's no function of your body that you do not entertain your daughter with while it is taking place, up to and including shaving your legs. I remember. Yes. That's right. I didn't know that, did she? It is extraordinary, but it is that, because it's the one place that has a lock. Anyway, you know, that's
have you finally got the perfect bath?
Well, it's a wonderful, I've got two, but I haven't got an ensuite, which I think would be the perfect bathroom. But it's pretty damn good. Although, I won't name the newspaper, but some newspaper wanted to come and photograph my bathroom because the book had, you know, obviously they'd read the book or something. And they wanted to do a feature on it, and they came down. Of course, it's not grand. I don't need grandeur. I don't need marble pilasters and, you know, great swags of stuff. I just want nice bath, clean walls, pretty things, and a view out of the window, very big window. And I can't tell you, the photographers were in that bathroom for 2.5 hours. It's 8x7. Unless I'm Craig, can't you? But I really did, and when I was dealing with builders, which is a whole, it's going to make the plumbing really difficult, they said. You know, the pipe will, much easier to have it. I just didn't understand. I stood my ground on that one. Yeah. Well, I've never had the only problem I've ever had was when someone mistakenly thought she was someone. That was when, in the very early days, I had a very rich girlfriend called V, who took me for lunch at the Savoy to celebrate my first book, and she was using a gold card, and I'd never seen one. She was even new thing, especially for a woman to have. So later, I think in Dog Days, I think, I had a friend of the heroine buys her Tampax with a gold card, because that was quite funny. And B took against it and thought it was her. But 8 years later, I realised something bad was going on, and she said. I'm very careful to not upset anyone unless they've really upset me. But I think if they've done something really bad to me, then it's okay. And in Yesterday's Houses, there is a bit where a certain person writes a poison pen letter about the heroine, which truly happened. And I've waited a long time to put that in print. And I take no prisoners if I feel it's acceptable. Yes. Oh, Janet. She's a writer, yes, she's a writer of romantic, highly romantic stuff. No, not at all. I think it was wishful thinking. Because the very idea that you could actually sit on the tube and look at people on the tube and therefore get your characters for your next book that way seemed to me such a wonderful thing to be able to do, as opposed to, you know, pacing the floor and staring bleakly out of the window at blackbirds. But no, I didn't. A lot of people, a couple of writers I know, say, I've pinched that idea, that's how I do it now. I might try, it'd be quite fun to do sometime, actually. It'd be quite fun to do. Dear Janice. Janice Gentle was the first real novel I wrote, actually. It was my fourth book, and the first three were great fun, and quite throwaway, and what you might call now henlit, but always with an undertow of pain. I think all humour had an undertow of pain. I think there's something more serious about them. But Janet Gentle really was quite a major undertaking. Lots of characters, several subplots going on, and quite a sort of big story, big idea. It just happened. I was really pleased about it, because it made everything got deeper and more important and harder to do. Well, Three Men and a Plane, yeah. Three Men and a Plane is very interesting. Well, the thing about Three Men and a Plane, for those of you who haven't read it, is that it's about this heroine called, I believe, Pamela, who has three different men who are all interested, who all want to finish, you know, make relationships with her. Men that she's had relationships with have all come back to her at exactly the same time in her life, and all made overtures towards them. She has to choose which. It's a bit like, you know, choosing the three golden caskets and which one's got the severed head in it. And actually, the truth about that is that I did have... that at one point in my life, there was the father of my child, from whom I was many, many years separated, but we used to meet quite regularly and have, you know, dinner together just to talk about Bella and all that. There was an ex-lover who had broken my heart, who I would occasionally see in my life. And there was the current beau. How lucky I was then. And on one particular occasion, Bella's father rang and said, "I can't see you on Friday." "Oh, why?" I said. And he said, "Because I'm going to Dublin for the weekend." I said, "That's fine." He said, "Yeah, I'm going from Stansted," because Stansted was new in those days. "Oh," I said, "it'd be interesting to see what you think of Stansted Airport, you know, Foster, all that lot." Okay. Next thing, this is all on the same weekend, my ex-lover rang. I'd got a date with him in the diary for some point. And he said, "Well, let's make a date, but it can't be Friday because I'm flying to Dublin." And I said, "Don't tell me you're going from Stansted Airport on the noon flight." And he said, "Yeah, how did you know?" I said, "I don't know." And then my current lover rang and said, you know, that could I drop everything? Could I, you know, be free for the weekend? And I couldn't because of Bella. Why? I said. And he said, "Right, I'm going."
It was all true.
"Going to Dublin." I said, "Oh, really? Where are you going from?" He said, "Stansted Airport." "A noon flight?" He said, "Yes." So I immediately rang my friend Angela. I said, "God, what should I do?" And she said, "Get a black wig and get down there and see what happens." So I wrote a book about it. Yeah. Well, for me, it was an interesting experience, because I began by wanting to write a diatribe against the beauty industry, which I was fed up with. But actually, what happened was that everywhere I went in the world, or any city I went to a beauty parlour, and I listened to beautician, and listened to the stories. But also, I gradually learned that what I was really railing against was, you know, the cosmetics industry. That actually the process and the experience of women having things done to them to make them feel better and look better is very ancient and very honourable. And so halfway through writing this, I had to start again, you know, begin the premise anew, because I had learned this extraordinary experience. And I want you to start it again, and I want you to imagine in your mind the face of the taxman when I claimed all those beauty treatments as part of research and got away with it. If nothing else, that is a reason for finishing that book. Well, really, tremendously. I mean, I always used to write for my agent, Imogen, who isn't my agent anymore. I'm always anxious. I'm always frightened of letting my readers down. It's just so extraordinary to me when people come up to me and they say, that book changed my life, or I've had letters from women who've been in deep grief. I've had letters from women who, you know, had postnatal depression, who said your book was the first thing that made me laugh. So, you know, very precious to me, my readers are. And I'm always worried that I'll let them down. I'm always worried about that. But in the end, you know, you have to write what you write and hope that they'll come with you. And luckily they do, mostly. There was the wonderful Vicar's wife in Cockermouth, who with my first book, Pause Between Acts, wrote and said, what a lovely book, made me laugh, you know, and really loved it, thank you so much. When I wrote Parlour Games, my second book, she wrote and said, oh dear, what a shame, there's quite a lot of bad language in Parlour Games, but never mind, you know, I expect this is your publisher trying to make you a little more sort of raunchy. Absolute silence from my third book. Never heard from her again. But I put her in Janice Gentle Gets It. I made her a gloriously red-headed romantic heroine in Janice Gentle Gets It. So, you know, I lost her. Interesting. I know there's one side of that which I will say, which is that no writer with a mortgage ever got writer's block. simple as that. And I do think of writing as a job. You know, when someone says to me, good Lord, have you written another book? You know, I always say, if they're a taxi driver, I say, well, how many fares did you take today? So, I, it helps me. I don't know what other writers think, but that's the way I think. But I think in the morning I get up and that is what I do and that is what I am. And actually when I'm not writing, even when I'm doing this, which is lovely to do, I should be writing. I can imagine lying on, you know, if I got very rich, I can imagine lying on a beach for about 6 months, drinking pina coladas and thinking that's it. And then creeping back to it, I think. I've always written, even when I was little. I mean, you know, when I was at school, I wrote an entire...